Hello, and welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be going, or wherever you may have been. I'm Dan, and through the next hour, I will guide you through the spectacular stories from Canada. We have a very, very good show today. You'll be hearing from actress and self-described fangirl, Jodelle Ferland. Her new show on space is called Dark Matter. You'll also hear from neuroscientist Mark Lewis. He has a book out entitled The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. It's a very informative talk. I hope you guys will like that. And finally, our music guest today is the Sheepdogs. They have a new album coming out in October. But right now we're going to hear a song from their previous album, also called The Sheepdogs, which was released back in 2012. This is Feeling Good.
Jodelle Ferland, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So, your show is Dark Matter.
Yes.
First, I just want to talk to you about, you got to go to Comic-Con this year. How was that experience?
Oh, I could go on for hours about how awesome Comic-Con was. I just love going to conventions in general. Even if I don't have to go for a TV show, I would have gone anyway. But I've never been to Comic-Con before, and I've always wanted to. And, oh my goodness, it was amazing. It was huge. I mean, I knew it was already, but I don't think I ever could have really dreamt up how gigantic it was and how many people were going to be there. I had such a great time. I got to meet the Doctor from Doctor Who randomly at a restaurant, and he signed my TARDIS backpack, and that was really exciting. And I think the best part of it, though, was meeting all of the Dark Matter fans in person, because we get a lot of tweets and things on social media, which is really awesome, but then actually getting to meet them in person and have them say that they love our show and they've been watching and telling their friends is really amazing, just seeing everybody there to support Dark Matter.
Sci-fi always has a pretty intense fandom, no matter what type of show it is.
Oh yeah.
Since you've been a part of this show, how have you found that compared? I mean, I guess it only would compare to something like Twilight.
I think we definitely have a pretty good fandom going already. I mean, even when there had only been a few episodes, but actually, even before the show came out, we had fans starting to make fan art and things like that. I think because there are people involved with Stargate and other of the sci-fi genre TV shows, that people were already excited about it, especially Zoe Palmer from Lost Girl. We had a lot of Zoe fangirls very, very excited for Dark Matter. So, yeah, our fans have been absolutely amazing. Tons of fan art and tweets and social media, everything. It's been crazy to see the support. It's awesome.
How did you get involved with this project? Had you read the comic book? Were you aware of it before you took this on?
I got an email from my agent about the audition, and I saw that it was based on a comic book, and I thought, wow, that's really cool. I've never done anything like that before. So I hadn't read it beforehand, but I definitely did when I saw that, and I thought it looked so cool. And when I read the script, I thought, wow, I'm really excited to watch this. And then I actually got to be in it. So that was, 10 times better.
And I understand you guys shot in Toronto. What was that like for you?
Interesting, because I have definitely filmed away from home many times, but normally it would be like 3 months tops. And this was for 5 months plus the month before for prep. So essentially I was gone for 6 months, and I've never done that before. So it was interesting, but I had a really great time, and everybody there made me feel really welcome and at home, so it wasn't too hard. And also I was on a spaceship every day, so really I can't complain. I had such a fun time.
How would you describe your character, Five?
Well, she's the little one of the group, and she's easy to underestimate because she looks different than everybody else. She clearly doesn't quite fit in. She's not the same as everybody else. You can't quite tell where she came from or how she got to be with people who are like that, because she's clearly different. But she's very sweet. She's very smart. And even though people underestimate her, by the end of the series, she definitely shows all of her potential.
That must be an easy thing to relate to as an actor. It seems like a lot of artists I have talked to over the years talk about wanting to fit in or belong to something. Was that something you could relate to in terms of that character?
Yeah, I mean, I relate to Five in a lot of ways, and in that way especially, yeah. I think everybody feels at some point like they don't quite fit into a group or something like that. So I definitely related to her in that way. And also she's just, she's weird and quirky, and I feel like that's me as well. So it wasn't too hard playing Five. I'm pretty similar to her.
I got to ask you about that fabulous hair that you sport in this series. Was that initially written into the script, or was that a decision between you and the creators?
No, there was a lot of talk about the hair before we started filming. Originally, before I had even gone for prep or anything, they asked if I would be okay with dyeing my hair blonde and cutting it. Because when I auditioned, my hair was very long and brown, like it normally is. You know, sometimes it's a little bit shorter, but when I auditioned, it was really long. And I remember my first thought when I got it, after I got over the excitement, was that I was worried that I was going to have my really long hair for years because it drives me crazy. And so I was like, oh, no, it's going to be awful. It's going to be long forever. And then I found out they wanted to cut it. I was like, great, yeah, totally. But they said that they wanted to dye it blonde or something. They weren't sure. But then when I got there and the hairdresser started talking about what she was going to do with my hair, I was like, oh, that's not what they said. And they started talking about all the different colors that they were thinking. And I'm like, what? I had no idea what they were going to end up doing. They were literally talking about all of the colors of the rainbow. So I was like, oh, goodness, let's see what happens. And then they decided on, you know, a green-blue color, which I was very excited about. The funny thing is that I actually had a green streak in my hair before I booked Dark Matter, and I had put it in after I auditioned. So I was like, oh, no, I have to get rid of this. And then they dyed my whole hair green, so that was pointless. Love it.
What was that, just that transformation part like for you as an actor? People always seem to talk about the hesitancy when it comes to changing their appearance. Was it a fairly easy transition for you?
Well, I was pretty excited for a change. I mean, I love colorful hair, and that's the sort of thing that I'm never allowed to do as an actor. You have to, you know, keep things pretty plain, a blank canvas, so that they can imagine you as whatever they want to for the roles that you're going for. So bright hair is definitely not a thing that I was ever allowed to do. So I was very excited. And it's interesting because it totally changes how you see the character. When I auditioned for it and I had the long brown hair, I saw Five a certain way. And then as soon as I had this, you know, short pixie-ish bright hair, it was like, she's totally different. And it made it a lot of fun to play her with that big change.
You mentioned that you got to spend your days filming on a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk a little bit about what the set was like, because with a lot of these shows, it seems to be quite big and extravagant. Just that aspect of the show.
I was blown away by our set designers, and I cannot believe what an amazing job they did in really a very short amount of time. Not sure quite how long it took them, but it's not as long as you'd think, you know, to build something so amazing and so huge. Every inch of it was just, like, you could tell that they put so much detail into it, the painting, the building, and it really felt like you were on a spaceship. And also, it's amazing the way that they built it to translate so well onto the screen, because even though it looks fantastic in person, I was amazed when I first saw the first episode, the first cut of it, and it looked so huge. It's already big in person, but it was amazing how they managed to make it look so incredible on screen, and they knew that that's how it would turn out. I mean, the first time that I went to set, I was already so excited, and then I got to tour the spaceship, and I was just geeking out so hard. I was so excited. I mean, it was incredible, and I literally felt like I was just stepping onto a spaceship, and, you know, sometimes I would pretend I was. When we were filming, I'd just be like, hey, I'm on a spaceship.
Well, okay, so
really fun.
If you could design or own your own spaceship, what would be on it?
Well, you know, if I can have a spaceship, then I can have all sorts of fancy new technology. So, you know, obviously something that makes me whatever food I want. That's important. You know, I'm in space. I need to be able to have that sort of thing. I don't know. I think I would be happy with anything that takes me to space, really. But, you know, while I'm at it, why not make it comfy and and awesome, and with all of the little gadgets and screens and holograms and all that. Go all out.
So are you thinking more the Enterprise rather than the TARDIS, or is it TARDIS all the time?
Not the TARDIS. I want the TARDIS so bad.
everyone wants the TARDIS.
See, I have a hard time deciding, because the TARDIS is amazing, but I also think it would be cool to be on, like, Firefly-type ship. So in the end, though, I think I'd really settle for anything, because that would be incredible.
Speaking of the TARDIS, you mentioned off the top that you met Peter Capaldi, and I think I think you just made listeners everywhere jealous and angry.
Oh yeah.
What was that experience like for you, not only as an actor but just as a fan of the show?
Oh my goodness! I mean, just going to Comic-Con in the first place, I was just, you know, fangirling all over the place. I couldn't believe my luck that I was actually there, and you know, the other actors are having a good time, but I'm like, guys, you don't understand. We're at Comic-Con. And I was just having so much fun. And all, you know, all of my favorite TV shows were there, and a ton of actors that I love. And Doctor Who is one of my favorite shows. And I knew that there was going to be a Doctor Who panel, but I was doing Dark Matter press while that was going on, so I knew I wasn't going to be able to go to that. I was kind of disappointed. But then we went out for dinner that night, and the Doctor Who, you know, group is right next to us, the table next to us. And I didn't even realize at first. And somebody said, hey, Jarell, isn't that the Doctor? And I just, like, froze. I almost started crying. I was so happy. And, yeah, it was incredible. I mean, yeah, both as an actor and as a fan. Our producer literally had to take me over to introduce me because I couldn't move. Too excited. There's no way I would have been able to get up and go introduce myself. But yeah, I definitely fangirled very hard, and I was so excited.
What are you looking forward to in season 9?
I don't know. I'm just looking forward to seeing more of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. I know that people are always hesitant when there's a change, but I'm really liking him so far, so I'm excited.
I'm actually looking forward to the guest appearance of Maisie Williams.
Ah, yes, I heard about that. That will be interesting. They're very good at keeping secrets with Doctor Who.
Yes.
I'm really excited to see how that turns out, because I don't really know much about it yet.
So just wrapping up on Dark Matter here. This is a Canadian series, and oftentimes Canadian shows have trouble breaking the U.S. and international markets. Why do you think that is? And is there something that the Canadian industry can do to give it more of a name, or is that not important?
I mean, I think, you know, some shows are only Canada popular, and some are worldwide, and some are only U.S., but I don't know. I mean, sometimes there's more that you can do, and sometimes that's just kind of the way it is. And it depends on the show and the network and the publicity that you get. You know, sometimes it will be something that airs worldwide or all over North America, but the publicity in the U.S. just isn't as good, and so it ends up only being popular in Canada, or I don't know. Who knows? I guess there are a lot of factors. But it's true, that does happen. I'm definitely hoping that Dark Matter will be popular everywhere, though. The great thing is that we've had really fantastic, you know, feedback on social media and Twitter from everywhere. So that's really fantastic to hear. That's the cool thing about, you know, Twitter and all that today, is that we get to actually hear immediate feedback from everywhere, whereas before we might not actually know where people are enjoying it the most. You know, there we get the ratings and all of that, but to actually get personal messages from people all over the world that are really enjoying it is great.
I'm curious as to whether that direct contact with the fans and the feedback maybe affects the show in a creative way in subsequent episodes or subsequent seasons at all.
I think it does, yeah. I mean, the thing is that by the time we get all of those tweets, we're finished filming, so we can't change it too much. But we definitely keep that stuff in mind. you know, for later seasons. And we pay attention to that feedback, absolutely.
TV shows can often be a big commitment for actors, but do you like the fact that you could have a job now for, you know, 6 months a year for the next 3 or 4 years, depending on however long this thing lasts?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I cannot even count the amount of TV shows that I've auditioned for, because, you know, actors audition for a ton of things and they only get a small amount of them. It didn't even really occur to me so much that I would actually get it. I was just like, yeah, here's another audition. And I was very excited for it, but I couldn't believe my luck when I actually found out that I got the role, because I tend to not get my hopes up, you know. When I audition for things, I try to have the same attitude about all of them, even if it's something that I really want, because when you get your hopes up, it's very disappointing if you don't get it. So, yeah, I was incredibly excited. I mean, I could have got stuck on any series that I really, you know, wasn't as excited about, that I didn't quite relate to the character so much, or I, you know, I would have had fun on it, but maybe it wouldn't be the type of show that I would normally watch. And then Dark Matter is, like, it, you know, was made for me. I'm a geek. I like sci-fi. I love the character Five, and I really hope that it goes on for more seasons, because that would be fantastic for me. I would love to be a part of it for longer. I really hope I can be.
I know a lot of actors and a lot of young actors can be fearful of auditioning. what is perhaps one piece of advice you would give to aspiring thespians out there about conquering auditioning?
Well, I think I have to be perfectly honest and say that for some people it gets less scary. For some people it doesn't. For me it doesn't. I've always been nervous when I have to go for auditions, but I also think that helps, because if that goes away, then sometimes you don't do as well. You know, you have to, if you're nervous, it shows that you care. It shows that you actually care that you're going to do well. And if you're just casual about it, then, you know, maybe you're not as into it. So nerves are okay. And sometimes it actually makes you do better, because you've got that pressure to try and do your best. So yeah, it might always be scary, but, you know, you want to do well and they want you to do well, and the people in the audition room are there to help you, and just go in and do what you can and then leave it behind you, because if you just dwell on it after that, that's not going to do anything.
Quickly before I go, I wanted to ask you, I was looking at the cast list, and you got to work with Will Wheaton and Ruby Rose. Come on, like, leave some for us, will you?
So here's the thing with Will Wheaton. I did not know that he was going to be on the show. Nobody told me. And I was sitting in my hotel room, and I had finished for the day, and I saw something on Will Wheaton's, I think his Facebook or Instagram page, and it said that it was a clue to something that he was working on, and it was a really small piece of a logo, and I was like, oh, I wonder, wait a minute, that looks kind of like the Dark Matter logo. And I grabbed the call sheet, and I compare it, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, who didn't tell me? And I texted Joe, our writer, and I was like, okay, so you're in huge trouble. We have Will Wheaton. Why didn't you tell me? And he's like, oh, I didn't know that would be important to you. And I'm like, I am so mad. And so I never got to meet him.
Aww.
Yeah, but I'm hoping I will some other time. Anyway, everybody on set knew they were in big trouble for not telling me, but I'm still very excited that he was on the show.
At least now you can say you've worked with him in some capacity.
That's true, that's true. I still have bragging rights. And also, Ruby Rose was amazing, and I did get to work with her, and she was the sweetest, so that was awesome.
Well, the show is Dark Matter, and it airs Friday nights on Sci-Fi?
Yeah, Friday nights.
Friday nights.
Science Space.
On Science Space, yes. Joe Del Ferland, thanks so much for your time, and best of luck in the show, and we'll hope to see you at Comic-Con again.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much.
All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Once again, that was Joe Del Ferland, and you can catch Dark Matter Friday nights on Space. Next up, you'll hear Ewan Curry of the Sheepdogs talking about their upcoming album to be released in October, Future Nostalgia. Ewan Curry, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Cheers, brother. Thanks for having me.
So, you guys have an album coming out in October, Future Nostalgia.
Yes.
What can you tell us about the origins of this album?
That's so cliche, right? I know we went to the damn woods to make a record. we had all our stuff ready. Like, we had the songs before we went out there, and we'd rehearse them and stuff. So it was just basically, I think, no distractions, just not having anything around. Like I said, like, you know, oh, tonight there's, you know, this going on, you know, there's a show or there's a party or whatever. Like, there just wasn't that to distract you because we were away from it. And it meant that we were just, there was nothing to do but that. And it just, that sort of clarity and streamlined approach, it just kind of dials up the focus, I guess. It just means that that's all you're thinking about. And it was really fun. Like, I mean, we like making records, and it's really cool to experiment with different licks and different instruments and playing weird keyboards and just being in a really beautiful, like, environment. It just felt good every day. I wish we could do that all year long.
So the first single is Downtown. I had to listen to it, and what struck me is that it sounds a little bit more kind of old, like it's a rock song, but it's got a little bit of the more old-timey vibe to it. What was the process of putting that song together for you like?
You know, we just try to, I don't know, I think that song, we picked that one for the single, I think, because it's got like an immediate kind of riff, like it's got a good rock riff, but then it's got some nice sweet melody, you know, vocals in the verse. I don't know, I just like old music. I kind of have like old man taste, and, you know, hopefully we got enough energy and youthful spirit that, you know, it connects with young people too, I guess.
Is that, I mean, do you think that budding musicians or even young people in general should listen to that type of music? It maybe to sort of help them understand the evolution of that artwork at all?
No, I think they should just listen to whatever they like. I mean, personally, we always just try to make music that was similar to the kind of stuff that we listen to. You know, that's why we started doing it, because we wanted to make our own version of it. And so I think just listen to whatever you're into. You know, I could sit here and say you have to listen to, you know, these Beatles albums, and you must listen to these blues albums, and listen to Beethoven. I mean, you can do that stuff, and I do recommend it. It's interesting and cool, but, you know, I think if you're looking to make some music, just listen to, you know, as much as you can find of the stuff that you like, and do that. I mean, that's what we've always been about. It's just doing what you're into, and not necessarily a calculated move.
Your actual writing process, would you say you create your riffs first and then add lyrics, or does it vary from song to song?
It's almost always music first. It's usually like something like I'll be walking around and I'll think of something, and then I'll be in a public place, so I'll like go to into the corner and like sing it into my phone, and then like 2 weeks later I'll be playing around with the guitar, and I'll go through my phone and find that thing, listen to it, and then I'll sort of work on it from there. And so it's always kind of like the seed of the song is always musical, and I may have lyrical ideas like that I'll have sort of separate, and then I'll find, you know, how do I pair these two together, but it's almost always music.
What makes a good song for you? Like, how, what, you know, when you're sort of writing a draft, what makes you decide, okay, I think this is how I want it to turn out?
Well, I always think that the groove has to be there. I think that you got to have a rhythm or a groove that is sort of head bobbing or maintains your interest, or you could dance to at least slightly. That's always a big thing for me. From there, I think whatever vocal you're singing, whether it's a chorus or the verse, I think it's got to be kind of memorable. So I like simple things that are memorable and that kind of get caught in your head, because, you know, that's just what I've always liked, words, you know, hooks and catchy things, you know?
Yeah. Well, I feel like so many artists today try to make music and their songs more complex than they need to be. Would you say that there's something said for simplicity?
Oh, certainly. I mean, if you look at music on the pop charts, it's the simplest music ever. Like, it's just like basically a drum machine and like vocals, and it's just basically hook, 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 nonstop hook. It's the ultimate example of reduced, you know, of simple music being reduced to its simplest form. But even in rock music, I mean, it's just like, there's just some, I mean, like Led Zeppelin are this big badass sounding band, but a lot of times they were just like a power trio. So, you know, it's really quite simple. And yeah, I mean, I love simplicity. Although it's hard, man, sometimes you just want to get some crazy keyboard in there or do some horns or some, you know, crazy 10-part harmony or something.
But do you think that's why songs become popular, is because fans can connect to the simplicity of it perhaps easier than they could if it had a, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 part harmonies?
Yeah, I think sometimes the simplest song is, it's just so direct and it's kind of undeniable, and it just, you know, it's just like, wow. It's kind of like when like Daft Punk come out with one of their hits, and it's just like really simple, and like even people who don't like dance music are kind of like, it's kind of good, you know, like it's kind of that thing. Just be undeniable.
So you guys are playing the Burnaby Blues and Roots Festival coming up on Saturday. Although when I hear the word blues music, I wouldn't necessarily think of Sheepdogs right off the bat. But what do you guys like about this festival?
We do only 12 bar blues the entire set. That's our special blues fest. No, I'm just kidding. I think if you go to most of these blues fests, they're not necessarily totally blues. They're pretty open. You know, it's kind of like folk fests. They don't have a lot of folk music at them either. But you know, we play rock music that is indebted to the blues. We don't do any 12-bar blues or any Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or anything. But you know, I think you can hear the influence in our music, and we just try to do our thing. We're not going to try and play any kind of Sweet Home Chicago or anything like that.
Well, I mean, most rock music, it seems, is in some part descendant of the old time blues music. Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly the older rock music was. I don't really hear a lot of the blues in like contemporary rock radio now. I wouldn't say so.
What would you say your favorite song off of Future Nostalgia is?
You know, I really like, we have a song that is called Same Old Feeling, and my brother plays this great honky-tonk piano on it, and it's just like, because this is the first album that my brother Seamus, who's our keyboard player, was on, and he really played some really cool keyboard parts, and I think it really brings this new texture to sort of our sound. You know, we're still very guitar-heavy, but there's some really cool keyboard sounds in there as well. But also the last 6 songs of the album. The album is like 18 songs or something ridiculous, but the last 6 songs are all a part of one big medley, and I really am pretty proud of that. It's pretty cool, just all these different songs flowing into one another.
Well, the album is Future Nostalgia, and it will be out in October. You and Curry, the Sheepdogs, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, man.
Cheers.
Take care.
And that was You and Curry from the Sheepdogs. You're now going to hear my conversation with neuroscientist and author Mark Lewis, whose book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease.
Okay.
Mark Lewis, thanks so much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, you're welcome, man. It's good to be here.
The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. I guess I want to start by asking you, in the context of your book, how you would qualify disease and what it is.
I guess a disease, well, It normally involves disturbance to an organ in the body, which starts to function in a way that's incorrect and that is destructive and so on and so forth. Of course, the brain is an organ in the body, so you could say, well, maybe then it gets under the radar. But usually we treat diseases with a particular course of medication or treatment or exercises of some sort that restore the organ to its normal functioning, as though, because organs in the body are have a homeostasis, have a stable condition, and we don't want them to change. We want the heart to keep doing what the heart does, and we want the lungs to do what lungs normally do. We don't want them to change. Whereas the brain is designed to change. That's its modus operandi. That's how it works, is by changing. That's how we learn. That's how we remember. And that's how we make, you know, I mean, all mental activities have to do with brain change. And therefore, you can't apply the same criteria to brain change as you do to changes in your, you know, pancreas or your liver.
So then would you flat out say that addiction is a choice, or are there other factors that play into it?
Yeah, no, I think it's a bit of a false dichotomy to say that addiction is either a disease or a choice, because it implies, first of all, that either addiction is this biological phenomenon, therefore it's a disease, or else it's this mental phenomenon, it has to do with rational thinking, and therefore it's a choice. But that's wrong in so many ways. First of all of our thinking and feeling comes from the brain, so everything we do is biological. So just to say that addiction is biological does not mean it's pathological. It doesn't mean that it's a disease. At the same time, choice is not entirely rational. As we all know, your choice of whether to go through an orange light or whether to stop is a choice that you make in the moment. It has a lot to do with context, with your mood state, with previous conditioning, with what you had for breakfast, how you're feeling, how frustrated you are. So choice is never a completely rational, you know, dry, objective exercise. Rather, it's coming from the same brain that is subject to all kinds of distortions and biases and, other non-rational processes.
Another issue that you talk about in the book, obviously is drugs. And I'm curious as to how you qualify what a drug is, because when people think of addiction, they think, okay, you've got heroin, you've got alcohol, you've got pot, but then there's also, you know, the prescription drug side of things. So how do we qualify that?
Well, you can be addicted to a lot of different things, as people often recognize, not only drugs, and including illicit drugs, also illegal drugs, but you can be addicted to gambling, to sex, to porn, even to internet games. Most of the eating disorders also overlap with addiction in terms of both the brain activation patterns, but also behavioral patterns, the compulsive nature of it. So you can get addicted to just about anything, and I don't really draw a sharp line between pharmaceuticals and illicit drugs. On the other hand, I would say there are some drugs that are not very addictive, such as the psychedelics, psilocybin and so forth, don't tend to be addictive because they don't provide a simple blanket of pleasure or relief or satisfaction, but rather they're kind of a gateway into exploring other ways of experiencing the world, and in that sense, they're just very different than what you get out of, the bad drugs, like meth and heroin, the drugs that we know so well.
On that note, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of the war on drugs and sort of the approach to addiction that is common here in the West.
Right.
If we legalized all the street drugs, heroin, meth, all, you know, ecstasy, like here in Vancouver we have a program called Insight, and they actually give heroin to addicts. If that was initiated on a larger scale, would that actually help curb addiction at all?
Well, it's an interesting question. I got an extensive tour of Insight, and the other 15 or so sites in that area that are run by the Portland Hotel Society, Portland Hotel Association, which is, you know, it's a social organization that helps to connect these people with their with the larger society, protects them, gives them a home, helps them to remain healthy, and so forth. So yeah, you would call that harm reduction. And in a number of countries in Europe, in Portugal, for example, they have decriminalized all drugs, including heroin, and all drugs. And in fact, it has had a very beneficial effect. There is less. There's not only less crime because people don't have to work as hard to get their drugs, but there's also less addiction. And that's really interesting. Why is that the case? If you make it more available, why should people be doing it less? Possibly because they are, once they're no longer marginalized and at risk, and you know, experiencing this great alienation from their society, they probably don't feel as much motivation to have to change their state. And so they can relax more and say, well, you know, this isn't so bad, and I feel better now, and I don't have to take so much of this stuff, and maybe I don't have to take any at all.
You mentioned at risk, and I know in the book you talk about inner cities, and I'm curious as to whether you think there's both an economic impact to addiction and a racial impact in terms of the types of people who are addicted.
Well, I wouldn't say racial, but I mean, Carl Hart wrote the book, which is called High Price, which is about how inner city minorities, poor minorities who are basically have very few choices in their life, may turn to drugs, not because they're so powerfully addictive, but because they don't have a lot else to do. It's one way to socialize. It's one way to make choices and to experience an interesting life when job opportunities and opportunities for stable, ongoing, responsible relationships are much harder to come by. I don't talk about that a whole lot in my book. The five addicts that I describe, I interviewed them in great detail. And most of them are, I think actually all of them were middle-class people who got into drugs, one case heroin, one case meth, amphetamine, one case booze, and another one is an eating disordered person. And they got into their addictions through nothing that had to do with oppression or, you know, societal or cultural problems, but rather problems in their own childhood would made them more vulnerable to addiction.
And within the war on drugs, what's often left out is that we have to start looking at this problem from a mental and psychological standpoint rather than, let's say, a criminal aspect. How much psychology goes into not only becoming addicted, but also the study of that addiction?
Well, I'd say it's all psychology in one respect. I mean, people become, it's a very specific psychological process. There's a particular activity or substance that you desire. The book is called The Biology of Desire because your brain is designed to focus on what is attractive. That's how it's designed. So you go after something, whether it's a substance or whether it's an activity like gambling. And the more you do it, the more you build synaptic networks. You build neural networks, that is to say connections among the neurons that provide an architecture that represents that activity. And that grows and is self-reinforcing and is self-perpetuating, and it kind of crowds out alternative goals and alternative activities, so you're drawn more and more to the specific thing and less to the alternative things. And even when that starts to turn on you and becomes less attractive and less fulfilling, you're still drawn to it because you have focused on it so much that you've got all this underlying synaptic software and hardware that holds in place that attraction, that particular attraction, and that attraction holds sway a lot longer than you think it might, because it doesn't really require you don't have to have a good time. You can, I mean, people keep smoking for decades, long after they've lost any kind of sense of pleasure from it. And it's the same with other addictions as well, which is why the book is called The Biology of Desire. It's not The Biology of Pleasure. The desire circuits in the brain are really important because they become honed and sculpted to keep you going after a very narrow set of goals, a very specific thing. This is what I like, this is what I want, this is what I need. Those changes are, take some time to reverse. They're hard to reverse. It takes effort, it takes work, but they have very strong psychological implications, and you feel a certain way. You feel empty, you feel, I need it, I want it, I gotta have some, otherwise I'm not going to be comfortable. And that's the psychological aspect, which is makes it so insidious and difficult to stop.
In recent memory, I think there are two bits of debate that I remember watching that were interesting. One was between, I believe it was Peter Hitchens and Matthew Perry, where Peter Hitchens basically said the same thing you're saying, that addiction was a choice, but I think he was probably more vitriolic in the way that he said it. What is different about how Peter Hitchens frames the choice argument?
Yeah, well, like we were saying before, he sees it as a straight dichotomy. So in his view, calling it a disease is a cop-out. And let's face it, you guys are choosing to do this thing because you like to get high. Okay, well, why not just come out and admit it? And I don't see it as a simple choice. I think it's a choice, but it's a choice that's strongly constrained by associations and experiences and biases and needs and wants and fears. A lot of addiction is not about pleasure. It's about, as I said, it's about desire. But it's not only desire for pleasure, it's also desire for relief. The people who take drugs and other addictive activities, they do it because it gives them some relief. And that's long after the pleasure diminishes and even disappears entirely. And Hitchens would never say that. He would say, you're just doing it because you're being self-indulgent, basically, and you should own up to it.
And the other one that I remember watching was, it was a couple of years ago when I believe Russell Brand testified before UK Parliament or some panel in the UK, where he was criticizing the notion about, you know, we have to protect these victims of crimes whose perpetrators are addicts, rather than tackling the issue of addiction at heart. How big an issue is that, and is there anything that we're not doing now that we could be doing differently in that area?
Well, it's a good point. In terms of the victims of crimes, we should always be protecting victims of crimes. Of course we should. And the fact that someone's an addict does not excuse or justify their activities, such as, you know, theft and robbery and especially violence, although most very very few drug users are actually violent, but there's a lot of theft. And yeah, we should protect the victims, but we should also deal with the problem at a deeper level, because addiction is not good. It's not good for the person who's addicted, and it's not good for the rest of society. And so let's get down to the bottom of it. Let's understand it a whole lot better than we have been, instead of, you know, tossing it off and calling it a disease in this metaphoric fashion. Let's really understand it deeply. Put together the biology of addiction with the sociology, with the psychology of addiction. Take those three lenses, join them, integrate them, really figure out what it's about, and figure out what we can do to alleviate it. And that's going to help the victims of the crimes, as well as the addicts themselves.
There are many drugs that are either fully illegal or in a gray area. And if everything was legalized, how would it change the health industry? I mean, there's drugs out there like ayahuasca or ibogaine that could potentially help people with their addiction, but they're not often talked about just because of their legal status.
Yeah, well, there's no rationale for making drugs like that illegal. It makes no sense. They're not harmful drugs. People don't get addicted to them. Ayahuasca is considered by many people to be a way of exploring yourself, getting to know yourself, you could have 10 years of psychotherapy condensed into a few evenings. Why should that be illegal? I can't imagine. It's very different from methamphetamine and heroin, which are strongly addictive. So I wouldn't take the law as a very useful guide as to what drugs should be condoned and what drugs should be resisted. I think we know a lot more than that, and we know that certain drugs are truly dangerous because they are so addictive, and other drugs are not, and we need to make those distinctions.
Speaking of using drugs as a way to sort of explore yourself, I'm curious as to how much your background in neuroscience and your studies in neuroscience help you understand your own addiction problems.
Yeah, so when I was in my 20s, I was pretty strongly addicted for about 3 or 4 years to opiates, and I committed crimes and did all the rest of that. Got in trouble and lost my girlfriend, lost some friends, got kicked out of graduate school. I mean, my life really turned into hell for a while. And like other addicts, it got bad enough that I really wanted to quit, and I did quit. And most addicts do quit because things get intolerable and you say, I've had enough of this. So, well, that in itself gives me some perspective. The neuroscience also gives me some perspective. Drugs like methamphetamine and heroin work very differently than drugs like LSD and psilocybin and ayahuasca. So I think there's a lot of ways to make that distinction. And just from my experience, from my own experience and that of friends and also the many people I've talked to who have drug issues, these are not the same substances. They shouldn't be considered to be in the same category at all.
And finally, we have an election coming up in Canada soon, and next year there will be an election in the States.
Mm-hmm.
What do officials and those in charge, how do they need to change their approach to further the conversation on addiction and mental health?
Well, it's a complicated situation, huh? I mean, there's a reason why the disease definition, the disease model of addiction, has become so prominent, so prevalent. It kind of keeps it under wraps in a certain way and says, oh, this is a problem, we'll just give this to the doctors and, they'll take care of it. But in fact, they don't have very good ways to do that. So a more farsighted approach, I think, would be to recognize it as what it is. It's partly a social problem, a very severe social problem. People who become addicted have had crappy childhoods in one way or another, very often have undergone periods of depression or anxiety, which might have been invisible up until the time they became addicted to something. And then it turns out that, yeah, guess what, that boarding school wasn't a very nice time, or, the Uncle Charlie wasn't so friendly to me when behind closed doors, or whatever it is. And we should be able to approach the problem in terms of its social roots and the childhood roots, the developmental roots, in order to alleviate the negative consequences of long-term addiction. And I think we can do that. We have the resources. We do that with bullying. We do that with anti-racism. We do that with spousal abuse. There's all kinds of social problems that we get in there at a social level and recognize them as social problems and throw money at them and throw expertise at them and try to fix them without ever calling them a disease.
Well, the book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Mark Lewis, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the good question.
Alrighty. Have a good one. Cheers.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that was Mark Lewis, and I spoke to him from Vancouver. That just about does it for the show this week. My thanks to Mark Lewis. My thanks to Jodel Furland. My thanks to Ewan Curry of The Sheepdogs. If you like the show, you can visit us at www.podswithbenefits.com. You can find me at Endeavors Radio. You can follow Pods with Benefits at pods_w_benefits. You can also find Leeman on Twitter at Leeman, LEAMINN. If you like the show, please consider clicking the donate button. We'd really appreciate it. We're going to take you out now with Sheepdogs. This is the single from their new album, Future Nostalgia. This is Downtown. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Plans. Don't say maybe it's good to feel alive and waste away your time. Close your eyes, my sweet baby, it's a crazy time. It won't change me, try to understand. I'm a complicated man, a diamond in your hand tonight. Save me, try to understand. I'm a complicated man. You try and split the band tonight.